thought I'd read you another Yeats poem. Are you up for more poetry? I'll read you another one. This is a very famous one called The Wild Swans at Cool. And, reading it, one of the things he touches on is this experience of seeing beauty in nature. And it's reminder of impermanence. It's reminder that everything is ephemeral and changing. And this connection between beauty and impermanence is another reason why beauty is a doorway to truth. It's another reason why beauty can be a doorway to insight. It's easy, I know it's easy to intellectualise and say everything's impermanent. We kind of all know that. But the heart doesn't always know that. And sometimes the heart does know it, but it won't accept it. It won't open up to impermanence. It's too painful a truth for the heart to open to. And if the heart doesn't open to it, then it doesn't become an insight. It doesn't really become an insight. Something about beauty is that, you know, it's so easy to open the heart to beauty, and then that lets in the truth of impermanence. Yep. Anyway, that's just me making that up. You don't have to. Let me read The Wild Swans at Cool. I'm losing my voice a bit, so you have to excuse me. The trees are in their autumn beauty. The woodland paths are dry. Under the October twilight, the water mirrors a still sky. Upon the brimming water, among the stones, are 59 swans. The 19th autumn has come upon me since I first made my count. I saw, before I had well finished, all suddenly mount and scatter, wheeling in great broken rings upon their clamorous wings. I have looked upon those brilliant creatures, and now my heart is sore. All's changed since I, hearing at twilight the first time on this shore, the bell beat of their wings above my head, trod with a lighter tread. Unwearied still, lover by lover, they paddle in the cold, companionable streams or climb the air. Their hearts have not grown old. Passion or conquest, wander where they will, attend upon them still. But now they drift on the still water, mysterious, beautiful. Among what rushes will they build? By what lake's edge or pool delight men's eyes when I awake some day to find they have flown away? It's exquisite, isn't it? It's exquisitely simple, this vision of beauty that is a reminder of impermanence, of death, of loss. So last week I was saying a little bit about what happens in the aesthetic moment, in a moment of beauty. What is it about that moment that that opens a doorway, at least potentially opens a doorway, towards the truth towards reality, towards, you could say, the enlightened experience. And one of the things last week we were talking about was that the object of beauty, whatever the object is, well, one of the things that it does is it attracts us. It seems to be, as it were, having a pull on us, like a magnetic pull. It seems to be directly communicating with us. And in that pull, we're more in connection with it. This boundary that we normally have between me and the world, between me and the object, starts to thin. Just for a bit, it starts to thin. So that was one aspect of the object. The other aspect of beauty that is potentially linked to this doorway is that in the experience of beauty, there can be pleasure, an open-hearted pleasure, without a grasping, without a self-centered grasping. So often, pleasure comes with grasping right on its heels, doesn't it? So you have a lovely meal and you instantly want more. Or you see a beautiful person and you instantly yearn for them, want them. But potentially, beauty can come without that grasping, particularly beauty in art and beauty in nature. When you've got beauty in art and beauty in nature, there's less to grasp. I know you can go into a gallery and say, I want that painting, I want it on my wall. But it's a bit ridiculous, isn't it, when it's a Turner or... you're never going to have it. So in a way, you can just sort of let that go and admire, enjoy, without the wanting. Or similarly, nature, looking at 9 and 50 swans clamouring on their great wings. You can't grasp that, it's ungraspable. And we don't even try. So in that ungraspable opening of the heart, in that selfless opening of the heart, we're closer again to the way things are. Or at least we're closer to the doorway that can lead to the way things are. And then there's one more thing that I was talking about last week, which is, I was talking about several things, but this one, which is that, well, sometimes in this appreciative aesthetic moment, our normal perceptual situation starts to just break down a little bit or dissolve a little bit. And by our normal perceptual situation, what I was getting at is our assumption that there's a real self, a real me, and a real world out there. Yeah? And ordinarily, what we're trying to do is navigate that world, getting what I want and avoiding what I don't want. And that is so often our approach to experience, to life. It's a utilitarian approach. And yes, it's a common sense approach. I accept that it sort of works, at least, to get us through. But from a perspective of enlightenment, it just causes pain. That utilitarian approach, when it governs experience, when it becomes the dominant mode of having experience, just causes pain. Because invariably, we don't get what we want, not completely, not forever, not so that it completely fulfills, and invariably we get what we don't want. So just having this attitude that life is all about getting what I want is a fool's errand. An aesthetic approach is contrasted with this, where in a way what we're trying to do is just appreciate the beauty in every situation. It's not about grasping or grabbing or having so much as appreciating. And if we can move from this utilitarian to this aesthetic appreciative mode, then in a way life starts to flow in a way that starts to just, as I say, dissolve this sense of separation between me and world. In that appreciative mode, in that aesthetic moment, it thins this separation between me and the world. And of course, that separation between me and the world, ultimately, the Buddha tells us it's a delusion. It's not just that it causes suffering and isn't very helpful. It's actually a delusion. It's a delusion imposed by our ignorance, by our thinking that we exist as a fixed and separate entity. And that delusion is the ultimate root of all pain, all unskillfulness, all pain. So thinning that delusion through beauty is a step closer to how things really are, to how an enlightened being would experience the world. So that's what I was talking about last week, is those three aspects of beauty, the aesthetic moment, that can help us move towards the way things are. Yeah. Let me just pause there before I move on and see if there are any questions. Or is that all quite clear?
No, it's all clear.
That's good.
I just wonder if you have anything to say about the middle path between the aesthetic and the utilitarian. Because from what you were saying just then,
yeah,
I sort of I can see that they can be set up as a dichotomy between the two approaches to life.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think maybe from my own experience,
yeah,
it might be that both of them
are needed
because just today, for example, I saw a robin.
Yeah.
And it was so beautiful, and yeah, it was just the aesthetic moment, and it did fill my heart with love for it.
Yeah.
And for animals generally.
Yes.
But then if I wanted to translate that into a metaphor act, I mean, it already was good because I'd felt love, so that's always a good thing. But, I might want to do something like,
yes,
join the RSPB, for example, in which case I would need an element of utilitarian thinking.
Yeah. So I think that's a really good point. It's an intelligent point. And you can't, You're right, you can't just live in that aesthetic moment without some degree of practical, pragmatic, utilitarian things coming into play. And nor would it be desirable, because the danger would be that we'd just become aesthetes. And last week I was talking about aesthetic appreciation without ethics is just aestheticism. It's actually just a refined selfishness. And that's not what we're looking at. You know how people... I was just watching this weekend La Grande Bellezza. Have you seen The Great Beauty? Wonderful Italian film. I really, really recommend it. We should show it, actually, at the centre. And it's a celebration of beauty. In modern-day Rome, contemporary Rome. It is exquisitely made. I mean, every frame, the sound, the visuals are gorgeous. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous film. But many of the things that it depicts are people just being pretentious aesthetes. There's this line, one character, this woman, says to this other woman, at a party, they're always at a party, and she says something like, do you like this music? And she says, and it's some sort of jazz track playing or something, and she says, oh no, the only jazz that's interesting anymore is Ethiopian. And it's this kind of snobbery and pretentiousness that colours much of the characters' lives in this film. And it's about one man sort of starting to see the hollowness of that in his own life. It's on his 65th birthday, and he is at his birthday party, and it's this wild extravaganza. I'll come to your point in a minute. It's this wild extravaganza. And on that same day, he learns that a former lover, his first girlfriend when he was 18, who he's never seen since because she left him, he learns that she's died. And something happens. He's probably not even thought about her for decades. And something happens, and he starts to just experience life differently and starts to touch on what real beauty is, what the great beauty is. It's not without an ethical dimension. So to come back to your question, the first thing I want to say is that ethics is really important, and in a way, this middle way, you could say, is about ethics, where you do think in terms of how can I be useful, how do I navigate my way through the world usefully, but you think in terms, if at all possible, as much in terms of ethics and helping others as possible. Yeah, so it's utilitarian, but for others rather than for oneself. That would be I think a transcendent middle way. But the other thing to perhaps say is that Bante talks about how, yes, you do need to, I don't know, go to work, earn a living. Most of us need to do practical things to survive. It's just that all of those practical utilitarian things should sit within a much larger perspective of aesthetic appreciation. What he says is that normally it's the other way round. We live our lives as if we've got to get all these things done on our to-do list. And then, yes, on a weekend for a couple of hours, we might be able to appreciate beauty. Yeah? If we're sort of lucky. And he says, actually, our whole tendency to life is, we've got it upside down. It should be the other way round. That all of what's most important to us should be something about appreciation. And frankly, if we live simpler lives, if we weren't so, I'm talking generally in our culture in the modern West, if we weren't so obsessed with having so much, we could live simpler lives, and frankly, we'd have more time for an appreciative appreciative awareness. So there is the need for utility and utilitarian practical stuff, but we've got it way out of proportion, according to Bante. And that's not easy. I mean, I'm not saying I get a lot, you know, I work here trying to help run a Buddhist centre, and I get lost in budgets and finances and management meetings and staff issues and, I don't know, all sorts of things. So it's not easy to sort of to stay with that broader, truer perspective of beauty. But meditation helps. One of the good things about meditation, I know that when we start to meditate, we normally do it because we want to be calmer, happier, stiller, have more perspective, etc., etc. But if you really carry on meditating, ultimately you have to, I think, let go of wanting anything from that meditation practice. It has to be more like a sense of devotion. Or more like a sense of doing it for others. To the extent that meditation is just one more good utilitarian thing to do so that I can get what I want, to that extent it runs out on us. Ultimately, it has to be more like appreciation, play, devotion, surrender, love. You meditate because you love, not because it's useful. Yeah, that's an ideal. I mean, if you're not there, make sure you meditate because it is good for you. So don't give up on the practical. Does that help answer your question? Good. So I'm looking at this material from talks that Subhuti gave on this retreat last November, and these talks are online. They're two sets of talks, Eros and Beauty talks, so two retreats. Both retreats were led by Padmavajra and Subhuti, and I'm looking at some of the second set. So if you want to follow up and hear the original, as it were, Subhuti himself, then do so. And Padmavajra himself as well. But one of the things Subhuti was saying is that, look, you can break down this perceptual situation that we've got in terms of subject, me, object out there, and the knowing that happens in between, consciousness that happens in between, me knowing the world. That is the unenlightened experience in every moment. The unenlightened experience is of subject and object, subject apprehending object. Yeah. And this situation is deluded, and the appreciative aesthetic moment starts to break it down a little bit. So last week I talked mainly in terms of the object, but also you can start to say, well, what happens to the subject? What happens to me in this aesthetic moment? Well, one of the things is that there's a sort of self-forgetting. There's a sort of self-forgetting, isn't there? That when you are in touch with beauty without this grasping, for a while you're free of self, to a degree anyway, because so much of the time, well, self is so defined by wanting. So to the degree that we can be free of wanting, we've got the space to be free of self. So that's one of the things that happens, that there's a freedom from self. But in a way, that's a negative way of talking. There's another way of talking which is more poetic and more difficult, but more positive. And that's to say that we start to experience ourselves more truly, more as we really are, not this small egotistical me that's always wanting, wanting, wanting. But in a larger, mythic way, we experience who we really are. Now, I'm going to try and talk about this, but the language that I'm using is poetic. It's not literal, because you can't talk about this thing in literal terms. One of the reasons you can't talk about it in literal terms is that all of our language, every word and grammatical structure that we can use, is based on this framework of subject, object, and subject knowing object. There's no other way of talking in our language. It's all based on subject and object. So when you're trying to talk about an experience that goes beyond that, sort of literal words are not enough. Fortunately, what you have got is metaphor and poetry and image. And it's metaphor and poetry and image that can lead you towards an experience where this framework is thinner or dissolves. Am I making myself clear? Does that make sense? So one of these... Well, a poetic image that Sangharakshita has used is the image of a gestalt. What he said is that it's as if all of us, each of us, has a life that's like an ideal life that we ought to be living, that we were born to live. there's a sort of ideal me living an ideal life, but it's not in space and time. It's an image that sort of shimmers outside of this normal perceptual situation. This is a poetic image, yeah? It's not a literal truth. But it's as if there's a gestalt, an image of each of us living an ideal life. An ideal you, an ideal me, living the life that we were born for. As if there's in this image, the assumption is that we are born to do something. There's a purpose to our life, there's a meaning to our life. And in this image, this gestalt is always present because it's outside of space and time. But in space and time, we're trying to unfold this life and live it in space and time. But what happens is we keep going wrong. We keep forgetting who we really are and what we should be really doing. We keep forgetting the gestalt, the ideal image of our lives. And in that forgetting, we keep going wrong and we keep getting distracted by what we think we want. Yeah. And then every so often, we might remember. And it's as if we get this kind of wake-up call that says, hang on, surely I should have been doing something more. Surely there was more that I was here for. Surely there's more to me. Surely there's more to life itself. And those wake-up calls are opportunities to, in a way, well, reorientate. But very often, we don't pay attention to them. Now, the Dharma life, the meditative life, is a way of attuning ourselves to this gestalt more and more so that we don't forget those wake-up calls. In fact, so that we stay more and more in touch with what this image of our life is trying to tell us. Yeah. Sometimes, we can glimpse it in meditation. Sometimes we can glimpse it in dreams. Sometimes it's not as tangible as that. Sometimes it's more just an intuition. Sometimes I've heard people say they walk into the Buddhist center and they know that they've come home. And that language of coming home is like saying, oh yes, this is what I always should have been doing. This is where I belong. That's people being in tune, intuiting this gestalt. Yeah? It's an experience that we can all have, but we don't often pay attention to it. Sometimes other people can see it in us more than we can ourselves. So, you know, I used to work in IT for Marks and Spencers, and I was terrified of leaving my job. It meant security, it meant status, it meant money, it meant a lifestyle, it meant, you know, it meant freedom to me at the time. All sorts of things. I was terrified of leaving, and yet I was dissatisfied with it. I could tell that actually it wasn't enough. But it took somebody else, it took Maitre Bandhu to point out to me, what he said was, you're too big for Marks and Spencers. You're bigger than that. And I thought at the time, that's a strange thing, I'm sort of middle management, I'm not, you know, there's a long way to go, it's not. But he was completely right. In retrospect, my life now is much, much bigger than any corporate situation could contain. Do you sort of mean? And that's not just me being special. We're all too big. We're all too big for what we normally identify with. If you identify with your work, you're limiting yourself. Your image of yourself is too small. If you identify with your relationships, your family, your house, your possessions, in fact, with any mundane aspect of experience, it's too small. We are bigger than any thing that can be contained in space and time. There's something in us that cannot be contained. And to not live in contact with that is suffering. It's painful. Because we somewhere know that we're cramped, that we're living a cramped, narrow life that isn't really what we should be doing. And often, unfortunately, it's not until we come to die that we have those thoughts, and then we think, oh, I've wasted, I haven't lived, I've wasted time. So the Dharma life is lived to break out of this cramped, narrow sense of who we are to something that cannot be contained by any mundane definition. But because it can't be contained, it's difficult to talk about. But that doesn't mean that it's not real. It's not literally real. It's not that there's a literal image of you up there. But it's more real than the delusion that we live in, which is to think, oh yes, I'm such and such a person, doing such and such a job, with such and such a house, with these ambitions, and next summer I'm going to go on holiday. What a pathetically narrow vision of what human existence is. So this image, this gestalt, is more real than that. It's who we really are. Now, in the aesthetic moment, there's an opportunity to experience ourselves in this bigger way. Yeah? And you can train yourself in that, and meditation is a training in that. Because actually, everything that I'm saying about aesthetic experience also applies to meditative experience. It's not just about art and nature. It's not just about pretty swans and beautiful paintings. It's about meditative experience where you explore your own mind. And in meditative experience, if you go deeper, if you allow yourself to go deeper, you experience this bigger you that cannot be defined, that will not be contained, but insists on being lived. Yeah, that's the gestalt. So when we talk about beauty, we're talking about finding that gestalt and aligning our lives more truly with it. So we pause there and see if there are any questions. Does that make sense, or is that too obscure?
Yeah. This ideal self, something stable and unchanging that we're trying to grow towards.
So that's a good point. So what we've got to be careful of is not to... did everybody hear that, by the way? Let me paraphrase your question. That Buddhism teaches us that nothing is permanent, that there's no fixed self, there's no fixed entity called me. So is this ideal self... How does that fit with that teaching? And what we've got to be careful of is not to mix levels of discourse. So when Buddhism talks about anatta, or no self, or impermanence, it's talking in a metaphysical way. It's talking about the nature of reality as accurately as it can. When I talk about a gestalt or an ideal self, I'm not talking metaphysics. I'm not talking about a real entity. I'm not talking about something that actually exists in that metaphysical way. I'm talking about an image, an intuition, like a poem, like a metaphor of something that cannot really be defined. And if we try and define it in that metaphysical way, we get into all sorts of trouble. We get into sort of metaphysical hot water, philosophical hot water, because yes, then, you know, who is this ideal self, etc., etc. So, no, I'm not talking philosophy, I'm not talking doctrine, I'm talking an intuitive image, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
But in that image, there's truth. It's almost like real myths point to deeper truths. Yeah, they're not just stories for children. Real myths point to deeper truths about life, about the universal truths. And this is saying that there's a myth of our lives. Each of us has a myth of life, of our life, pointing to a deeper truth about who we really are and what we should be doing. Yeah? What we should be doing. And in a sense, that myth is individual. So it will have a different hue, a different shape, a different language, a different it'll be a different image for each of us. And in another sense, there's a universal arc to it, and that arc is always about moving from selfishness to less selfishness to an unselfish love. That is the human arc, the ideal life. But each of us will express that differently in our own lives, in our own ways. But it is something to do with moving from self-centeredness, selfishness, to transcendence of selfishness. That would be one way of talking about it. Yeah? And in that, what Buddhism says, remember, Buddhism doesn't have a martyrish thing. When I talk about transcendence of selfishness, it's not the same as being a martyr. Buddhism sees this as ultimate fulfillment. It's what leads to ultimate fulfillment. That's why I'm talking in terms of a myth of an ideal me living an ideal life.
It's interesting that is the language we use to ourselves. Like I know, like at my sort of deepest moments.
Yeah.
We do say that to ourselves. We say, well, oh, this is what I was born for.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody.
Yeah.
You know. That's what we. That feels true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes what happens
is
that we intuit some value that's ultimate. Mm. Say like freedom. Mm. Yeah. But we then debase it in what we look for freedom in. So what I'm trying to say is, so freedom is an ultimate value. Yeah, that's a one way of talking about enlightenment, is ultimate freedom. But what do we look for freedom in? We all have a sense of freedom, but we often look for it in, well, I don't know, a young person might look for it in fast cars, or you look for it in terms of that skiing holiday, or some sort of thrill ride, or getting drunk and losing control, or whatever it is, or earning lots of money and then being able to go on the holiday of a lifetime. Do you see what I mean? The value, the yearning is there for freedom, but our ambitions are quite low. They're almost like, they're such a debased, low ambition that, yeah, we do experience some degree of freedom, but it's very limited. Yeah, and the ultimate freedom eludes us. So again, with this myth, look for what do you value in your life, and then how do you look for those values? How do you fulfil those values? So let me just speak personally again, indulge me. So one of the values that is very dear to me is truth with a capital T. Wisdom, you could say, understanding the way things are. That's been a motivating drive in my life. But as a young man, that took on rather debased forms. Not so debased form was that at university I chose to study physics. And that's not a bad thing, but in my mind, I had this notion that physics could reveal truth. Yeah, and that's a delusion. But I was after truth, and that was the only way I knew how at that time. Or when I was working in IT in this corporate world, my main role for the last number of years was to somehow be guardian of the integrity of our databases and to protect the integrity of our strategy for IT systems and stop people who wanted to just be expedient and make some sort of quick, profitable manoeuvre, stop them if it didn't have a long-term truth to it. Do you see what I mean? And I loved my job because I thought that I was defending the truth. But all I was defending was the computer systems of Marks and Spencer's and making the delivery from supplier to store a little bit more efficient. It was a debased notion of truth. But the myth was still alive, but I was rather blind. So something was still trying to work itself out in my life, but through rather blind, dusty eyes. So look at our life. What are we doing with our life? Now, in what we're doing with our life, there are real values. We're always drawn by values, but often those values are being debased. Yeah. And the myth is being impoverished. So part of this is becoming more conscious of what the myth is, what those values are. Yeah, Alex. Yeah.
You've
got
it right.
Yeah.
But actually, that means that you haven't, and that there will always be a less debased version of your myth available. You see what I mean?
There's something in that, but my own sense now for me is that I am living the life that I ought to be living, but I'm not able to live it as fully as I'd like. So what I mean is that in my life, I've got all the conditions to practice the Dharma, to move towards, you know, less self-centeredness, to love. I've not only got all the conditions, I've been given all the teachings, I've been blessed with friends, I've got an environment where I'm living and working in which supports all of that. So in that sense, I feel I'm living the life that I ought to be living. But in another sense, I'm not. And the reason I'm not is that I'm not up to. My own limitations hold me back from living it fully. Do you see what I mean? And until enlightenment, that's always going to be the case. So I feel, for example, for me, I feel that at the moment, I wouldn't change one thing externally in my life. I mean, I probably would, but grant me the poetic license. that fundamentally, I wouldn't change anything externally. Fundamentally, I'm happy with the external conditions. I feel that I've got everything I need to live the life that I ought to be living. But I'm not always able to be present to that. I'm not always able to be emotionally engaged with that. A lot of the time I want my pleasures. I want my chocolate cake. I've got a dessert half eaten waiting for me in the kitchen of my community this very evening. So there you go. So that's me not being able to live up to it. So you can always do more. There's more and more renunciation involved. There might need to be more and more renunciation involved. The trouble is that you can't force renunciation and you can't rush it. This is, again, why beauty is so important. because to force renunciation when one's not ready is just repression. You know, so if I was to say, okay, I need to become a monk and I'm not ready, then all that is a repression, and that leaks out in some other way. So what has to happen, I think, well, not I think, this is Sangharakshita saying, is that you have to move towards greater and greater fulfillment. And when you move towards greater and greater fulfillment,
fulfillment of
your needs, your wants. So for example, in beauty, in the experience of beauty, you can be, one can be really fulfilled without this sense of wanting. And if I could live more in that experience, that wanting would naturally decrease. The more appreciative I can live, the less grasping I experience. And that is my experience, that, you know, I have been able to leave behind certain things, but only when I found more fulfilling things to take their place. So, for example, just a crude example, as a young man, a lot of my social life used to involve going down the pub with my friends, with my colleagues. And most evenings, I wasn't ever a heavy drinker, but that's how my social life revolved. It wasn't until I started, and I didn't have this kind of guilt thing around that. That was just fine. And it wasn't a problem. It wasn't an addiction. It was just fine. But when I started meditating, I started experiencing real pleasure in my meditation practice and a real sense of contentment and ease and peace in my life. And what I noticed was, if I went drinking the night before, when I tried to meditate the next day, I couldn't. Or at least it wasn't as effective. And actually, it lasted 2 days. The effects of drinking lasted 2 days into my meditation practice. And it was only when I started meditating that I noticed that my sensitivity became refined enough to notice that. So I started to enjoy meditation more than I did the drink. And then it wasn't a problem to stop drinking. And it wasn't some big moral thing, like this is bad or sinful. It was just that I was in touch with a greater satisfaction, a greater fulfillment. And then that changed my social life. So I then didn't want to go down the pub so much, because it was no fun watching other people get drunk while I wasn't. Yeah, and I started coming here more, where people weren't drinking and were into that sort of thing. And somehow that started to change my friendships, because I started to get to know people here. And then, do you see, my whole sense of what was enjoyable was changing. So there was a renunciation, a letting go, but not in a forced way. That's what this path of beauty is about. You move to higher and higher levels of enjoyment, of pleasure, of beauty, of fulfillment, and the lower and lower levels just drop away. Yeah? Yeah.
How do they do it? Deal with this,
well,
is it repression?
I think in the Buddhist East, I think that the whole monastic thing is problematic. It's part of the reason that in Tri Ratna we don't have a monastic order. What we have is an order based on commitment, and then people work that commitment out in their lives in different ways. And some people are celibate and have become monks or nuns. Some people are living with their partners or families, have got kids. Some people are sexually active, but they're living in a community, like I'm living in a community. Or I don't know, a whole range in between. Like when somebody's on retreat, they might be living as a monk or a nun, but that's a temporary period, and then they come back and they're living a sexually active life again, or worldly life again. So in Tri Ratna, what we're saying is that if you understand the principles of commitment, of moving to greater and greater fulfillment, then you can work out what's appropriate for you in your life. In the Buddhist East, I think it's problematic because what they say is that the real Buddhist is a monk. Yeah, and then actually that leads to a lot of hypocrisy because not all monks are genuinely monks, I'm afraid. They're not the real deal. A lot of it is show. And even if they are celibate, I don't know, giving up sex is actually not the main issue. You can be celibate and be really unpleasant and unkind. Yeah, and in fact, if you're not careful, you can become like that. You can just become bad-tempered and irritable. What Tri Ratna, what Sangharakshita is teaching is that the real way of practicing is to learn to love more. That's metta. That's what we're learning. And then in that, yes, let's see if we can give up grasping. Yeah, but learn to move towards greater and greater fulfillment. It should be a rich life, not a poor life.
I think I struggle with the idea that if you're living a normal life, a life in a community, there's always going to be wanting.
So in a way, I wouldn't worry about that. I'm going to have to move on from this topic, but... I wouldn't worry about the ultimate just yet, which is this ideal that feels so distant, doesn't it, that we might be able to not have any wanting. Wouldn't worry about the ideal. All I'd look for is, can I experience a little bit more contentment? And this path of beauty, this path of meditation, is that path. You know, for 20 minutes or 40 minutes, actually, we all sat here this evening before tea, and it was a very still atmosphere. And my guess is that everybody experienced a little bit more contentment than they had before arriving here. That's enough. Just look for that little bit more. And beauty is one way of doing that. Yeah? Looking for appreciation. That's what we're talking about. But yes, just to recap before we move on, that there is this notion, and it's a poetic notion, of an ideal me and an ideal life, a myth, a gestalt that's somehow existing outside of space and time that I'm trying to discover and work out and live in space and time. And this sense that when I'm doing that, and when I'm aligning myself with the life that I should be living, I experience a sense of meaning and satisfaction. And that when I'm not, I experience a sense of crampedness and, well, dukkha, suffering. So that's looking at this perceptual situation through the lens of the subject. And then lastly, and very briefly, I want to touch on what happens in this aesthetic moment to this consciousness, to this knowing, the subject knowing the object. What happens to the knowing? And I touched on it last week. What Subhuti's describing is that this knowing takes on a different form to our usual mode of knowing. Now, normally, when we say knowing, we have, well, two ways of knowing. One is through perception, through sense perception. That's one way of knowing something. Eyes, ears, nose, etc. And the other is through conception, through thinking, through ideas. That's another way of knowing. Yeah. But both those ways of knowing, perception and conception, are within this framework of subject and object, subject knowing object. When that framework breaks down, when we're talking about a mode of experience that isn't about me knowing the world, well, how do you talk about it? And I've already said that language is inadequate. Ordinary language is now inadequate to talking about ways of knowing, because all ordinary language comes from perception or conception. So what is it that lies outside perception or conception? Unfortunately, there is a way of knowing that is beyond or outside perception and conception. There's another way of knowing. And yes, language is not that good at talking about it. But one word that we can use, although you have to use it in a way that is a bit different to our normal usage, one word that Sangharakshita uses is imagination. Imagination. But he uses it not in the normal way of me having a daydream. He's using imagination with a capital I in the sense of being in touch with this larger me and this appreciative awareness of the world where the boundaries have thinned between me and world. It's this larger sense of myth that poetry can get at, art can get at, nature can get at, myth can get at, meditation can get at. It's this faculty that we all have, but most of the time we don't take it that seriously, and we certainly don't try and cultivate it. We don't kind of develop it. We might develop our perceptual faculties, and we might develop our reasoning faculties, but we seldom think in terms of developing our imaginal faculty. And this imaginal faculty is the faculty that will apprehend things as they really are. This is the faculty that will lead to insight. This is what insight means. It means perceiving, seeing with this imaginal eye, seeing things as they are with this imaginal eye. And that is the goal of the whole of the spiritual life. That is the goal of the Dharma life. So this faculty, this way of knowing, this way of seeing, is essential to cultivate. Yeah, we've all got it in germinal form. Some people have it more developed, but we can all cultivate it further. And this path of appreciation and beauty is a way of cultivating this imaginal faculty, but also living in it. When we're in that aesthetic moment, we're in it. That's what we apprehend. When Yeats saw those 9 and 50 swans, he didn't just see some large white birds. He saw, when he saw with the imaginal eye, he saw a poetic truth about life. He saw something about love and loss and the beauty of that. He saw these magnificent creatures as lovers, and he saw that there was a inevitable loss in that, and that he was now old, and that the swans were still there, but he was no longer the young man that first saw them 19 years ago. And that pointed to a deeper truth. So he saw with the poet's eye. And if we can develop this imaginal faculty and see with that poetic eye, everything then becomes a doorway to truth. It's not just beautiful swans. Everything, literally everything, is trying to teach us about the fleetingness, the preciousness, the beauty of the human condition, and the fact that what is important is moving from this self-centered, narrow, cramped way of being to a larger, more true, more real, more connected way of being that we use the word love for. That's what's being pointed to. So maybe on that note, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.